You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 92, Social Media and Mental Health with Dr. Andrea Howard, Part 2. You're listening to Part 2 of our special series on social media and mental health, recorded live at Carleton University. This event was presented by the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences and the Faculty of Science, and features Dr. Jim Davies, Dr. Kim Hellemans, and Dr. Andrea Howard unpacking what the science really tells us about social media's impact on youth. In Part 1, we explored how social media platforms hook our attention, what the research says about social media addiction, and practical tools to manage our usage. If you haven't listened to it yet, go check it out before listening to Part 2. Today, in Part 2, the conversation turns towards parenting, policy, and prevention. You'll hear a discussion on the efficacy of recent school bans on phones and social media, the responsibilities of parents and governments, and how and when social media can become a coping mechanism. Let's get back into the conversation.
So what about parents or the government? What if there were some organizational thing you wanted to do to decrease it? What actions could be taken?
So I got a lot for parents and I got a lot for government. So I don't know, Andrew, do you want to start?
I have opinions.
I'll speak to the parents piece, which is what I was kind of alluding to before, is that don't insert your worries about your kids' behavior onto, you know, what they're doing. I mean, it's of course important to, you know, be mindful of what's going on with your kids and signs of distress. And a lot of the work that we have shows that it's kids who are in distress are bringing their problems with them when they go online. So it's not necessarily that because you're seeing them online and they're having problems that it was the online environment that caused those problems. There's, you know, things happening online that might exacerbate existing problems as well. So that's kind of the, you know, the general parenting strategy of know your kids, look out for changes, and you know, making sure you're kind of, you know, mindful of what's going on in your kids' lives. The kind of advice we've been giving parents for 50 years. That applies to a social media environment as well. But you've got a longer list there.
Well, yeah, and definitely I agree 100% with a lot of what you were saying. The first thing is definitely to model healthy social media use, right? And I'm guilty of this as well. Like, it is something that I'm trying to be more mindful of, is when I'm sitting at home and I'm scrolling and my kids are asking me questions, I'm like, what? You know, and I'm not paying attention to them, right? And so it's about, you know, avoiding that as best you can without shame and blame and judgment, because that never goes well. I've worked in addiction field for 20 years. Let me tell you, shaming people does not change their substance use. Neither will it change your child's social media use. Demonstrating how you're using this intentionally, like, oh, I'm just kidding, you know, like, that's what I say, you know, my husband, like, what are you doing? You're just scrolling. Actually, I'm texting a friend that I haven't talked to in a long time, and I really want to connect with that person, and I'd really like to hear about how they're doing. So yeah, creating an open, judgment-free dialogue, that's definitely what Andrew is saying. Make it a non-taboo topic of conversation. You can ask, I'm always a big fan, if I had a different podcast, you know, don't worry, I'll never leave you, Jim. It would be called Curious, Not Judgmental, because I love that. That's actually a line from William Blake poem. But ask curious, non-judgmental questions. What do you like about TikTok? You know, tell me, you know, what are your interests here? What's pulling you in there? You can even open it as an over, like, have you ever seen anything you're not comfortable with? Do you want to have a conversation about that? One tip always is about creating spaces in your home that are digital free, right? So at our house, it's the dining room table and the bedrooms. So my kids are not allowed their screens in their bedroom. My 14-year-old, like, so far so good, she does not take her phone into her room. She's not allowed it. My 11-year-old doesn't have a phone. So those are, like, something that I'm trying very hard to stay with, because we do know there's a lot of issues with kids and sleep in particular, because they're endlessly scrolling, you know, even all of us potentially. My mom's calling. I'm not free, Mom.
That's a human notification.
I know, it's my mom, human notification. I do want to touch on the problematic use thing, because I think Andrew raised a great point that it, for sure, traumatic experiences feed a lot into problematic behaviors in life. We know that that's one of the biggest predictors of a substance use disorder is the fact that early childhood experiences, or ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. What I would say is addiction or use disorders or problematic behaviors, that's not the problem per se, it's the coping strategy. So what I would be on guard for is your child, youth, teen, emerging adult going to their phone to cope with negative emotions? That is usually one of the warning signs, is if somebody's had a bad day and this is the only strategy that they have to get their mood better. So that's definitely what we see in our research. Holly's research has shown, if we're looking at university students, if they're telling us, I go on social media to cope with my anxiety, that feeds much more strongly into their mental health outcomes. So they're much more likely to have higher scores on depression and anxiety indicators, because it's about that problematic use. So look out for that in your teens and yourselves, right? Is this the only go-to thing? Is your child's mood changing? Are they sleeping less? Do they seem preoccupied? And so on and so forth. So I would say just be on the alert for those things. I don't want to go too much into long. Governments, I think, have a role to play here. I think we're at a precipice of, it's tricky, too much government involvement, right? And we're gonna talk about that shortly. But I do think government should be having conversations with these organizations like Meta to instill design features that don't promote these behaviors. I think that there is a role there for government, and I believe that we should also be looking at health surveillance. We should be looking at this through a public health lens. We should be having digital literacy conversations with youth. We should be engaging Ottawa Public Health. We should be engaging the school boards to definitely have these measures in place. I'm all about harm reduction, promote healthy behaviors. There are a lot of benefits to social media. It's going to be with us forever. It's not going to go away. We can't have an absence-based approach. So how can we empower youth and ourselves with the knowledge to know when I might be at risk for some of the negative experiences, including things like cyberbullying, associated with social media?
So about 99% of people access social media through their smartphones. And some schools are banning smartphones in school. How is that going?
Look, it's not going well. You don't need the government to ban phones in classrooms for an individual school to decide that kids have to put their phones away in the classroom. I think the Ontario government just implemented this as a rule province-wide. A lot of schools were already doing this. My oldest son's middle school, the rule is if you've got a phone, your phone goes in your locker when you come to school for the day. So if the teachers want to have a phone-free environment, that's fine. That is a thing they can do. What doesn't seem to work super well is sort of implementing system-wide bans because they're too hard to control and have consequences outside of what you're expecting. So, banning kids from Instagram and TikTok will push kids onto apps that aren't banned and less regulated spaces, and will take away environments that they have access to that they are using positively. There's also very weak evidence that they're actually successful. There's plenty of anecdotal evidence. So you can line up principals and teachers from select schools all around the world that are willing to say, look, I watched the kids and they were doing awful and everyone was a delinquent, and then we took phones away and the change was transformative, and they'll pick 5 kids from the school to march over to the journalist and say, everything's so much better since the principal made us leave our phones at home. So, I mean, that is it's not compelling evidence. If you look at South Korea implemented an overnight for under 16-year-olds. This was in about 2011, where they were required, and I think they could implement this systemically. They were not allowed to do any internet gaming after a certain time of night, so there was a curfew in place. They were worried about various kinds of well-being things and sleep. Implementing that stoppage resulted in something like an extra 1.5 minutes of sleep on average for kids. So it's not a problem you can ban away, right? You just said this, abstinence programs don't work. We have history with a war on drugs kind of environment and abstinence only sex education in schools. These are not effective tools. Kids need digital literacy skills, right? You don't force kids to learn cursive writing in schools so that, you know, they can stay away from the dangers of being excellent touch typists, right? They're eventually going to need that skill. I'm being a little flippant, but it's the idea is there, right? You don't want to sort of hold back a technology that young people will be exposed to eventually, and that they will need to know how to use as part of their lives. So, yeah, the long answer to your question, bans have been problematic, and I worry about them.
So I think that there's a difference between banning phones completely and banning them during class. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting, though, that it doesn't do any good to have a teacher ban them during class, or that we don't have evidence?
I think it's more of a neutral question. I mean, we didn't have smartphones when I was in high school, but we did have kids with ear pods in and Walkman on them, and teachers were constantly asking those kids to put that away. I think it's completely reasonable for a teacher to ask kids to put away their belongings in class. And if they're on their smartphone using social media, they're not doing the lesson. Like it's not that it's social. I also don't want them to be reading a chapter of an engrossing novel in math class, right? They need to put their belongings away in class, and a teacher asking kids to put their belongings away, regardless of what kind of tool that is completely reasonable.
I agree. I think what's happened, though, recently is that it's almost hit a reset button, right? It's been the opportunity for teachers and principals to say, okay, now this is in place. It's almost like been the slippery slope of students bringing in their stuff in the classrooms, and then, you know, to have a teacher say, put it away, well, I'm allowed it in so-and-so's class, and da-da-da-da. So I agree, I think that, we need to be measured with how we have these bans, but maybe this is an opportunity for us to really kind of go, whoa, you know, this has gotten a little bit out of control, and now we're having a sort of system-wide understanding that it is not okay to have this to be scrolling and texting in the middle of class. I don't know. I'm just, yeah, again, this is anecdata.
Yeah, like, I mean, if we weren't having a crisis level conversation about social media, I think I would still be irritated if my kid came home and said to me that, you know, they were just like allowed to play on their phones during math class.
Yeah.
Like, but you're supposed to be doing math during math class, so what's going on in your classroom? I do get annoyed when they have like movie time during class and they're not doing lessons. I mean, that's kind of a thing that's already happening, but there might have been, like you said, slippage, where there was just a lot of devices just being allowed to come out when there wasn't something else for the kids to be doing. But part of it is the sort of distraction, or maybe they're looking something up on their phone. So yeah, I agree, it's, you know, empowering teachers to have rules in the classroom about what kinds of activities you can and can't be doing while a lesson is taking place. That just seems completely neutral to me. Why would anyone have a problem with that?
So how is Australia's ban on they have this first age use, I think it's 16 years old. How's that going?
I mean, it's pretty new still. So there's a lot of folks in Australia that are going to be following this really closely. It's a natural experiment. So you kind of have that sharp date where you're going to be able to see behaviors recorded before and after the ban went in place. But it's been like a couple of months. So it's way too early to know. But I think you're going to find that we're not going to have simply resolved mental health problems in Australia as a result of implementing this ban. There's probably going to be no meaningful change there. And you'll see kids finding other ways to get onto to apps. I'm not even sure how they're proposing to regulate that. How do you keep kids off of Instagram without invasive age verification? I mean, right now you're supposed to be 13 to get on Instagram, and we prove that by clicking a button that says, "Are you 13?"
like the Ontario Cannabis Store. I'm a cannabis researcher, this is why. But yeah. You get go on there. It's like, "Are you?"
Oh, sorry.
"Are you 19?" Yes.
Yeah.
I can.
Yeah, so I mean, I think those are like they've implemented a ban, but I think they're probably still working out exactly how to make that happen. So it's law.
Is it a cell phone ban or a social media ban?
It's a social media ban. It's an age-based social media ban.
So they can have phones?
Yes.
Yeah.
But like, try to police that, right? So
yeah
I don't even know that they've actually implemented it so much as passed the law. So
okay. All right, so what are some signs that someone might be using social media in a harmful way?
So again, I want to emphasize that the research is very clear that the associations between problematic or social media use and mental health outcomes, it's not about time or frequency. It's not like I'm on my phone for 10 hours, I will have more depression. No. The associations between social media use and mental health outcomes are about problematic use. So it is about these behaviors in which we're engaging with social media that are indicative of something akin to, again, being careful here with my language, something that looks like an addiction. And there are some warning signs. So like with other, with things like substances, people develop, like their moods will change, right? So you're gonna see much more irritability, particularly anxiety, depression could change because these are mood indicators. You might see sleep disturbances. Again, if it's your teen, this can all feed in because they're spending much more time on social media. There's indicators of loss of control, right? So people repeatedly opening apps without even thinking about it, right? So in back in the day when we started tobacco and nicotine use, there's cases of people who would be lighting a cigarette even before they were even aware that they had a cigarette in their mouth. So are you suddenly opening your phone, clicking on an app and not even being mindful or aware about that? You're feeling pulled to check social media first thing in the morning or in inappropriate situations like when you're in a talk on social media. During meals, driving, right? Engaging in unsafe use, right? Because that is, again, safety is a big feature and we don't allow people to drive under the influence of things like alcohol and cannabis, and we also don't allow people to text or be on their phone while they're driving, and certainly there are people who do this. You're preoccupied, you're thinking about social media constantly, even when you're offline. Particularly with youth, it's about your self-worth being tied to your likes and how your presence on social media can be an indicator. And then it's that compulsive checking of notifications, even when they aren't meaningful. So these are some of the sort of indicators that relate to those key features of like loss of control, compulsivity, preoccupation, undue self-worth associated with your online presence.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, from if you're somebody who's trying to keep an eye on a family member, then it's like what you said before, the solution there is to have an open dialogue about somebody's social media use, you know, asking them what they're doing or why do you seem so preoccupied lately when you're on Instagram or on Snapchat. And you know, those are probably the best ways you're going to have to figure out whether somebody actually needs some kind of help.
Okay, so do we know if certain types of social media platforms or ways that we use it are better or worse than others?
I don't know that that's really settled at all. There's, you know, you've got your sort of video-based platforms like TikTok, Instagram to some extent, it's very visual. You've got things like Snapchat that's in a lot of ways a text messaging service, not necessarily what you think of traditionally as social media. Microblogging stuff, formerly it was Twitter or X, is still popular with somebody now, I think. I'm personally on Blue Sky a lot. There's so many apps and they have different functions, but when we've measured social media, we ask people just, you know, how many hours do you spend on social media, and we get lots of definitions. So that precision isn't really there. There have been studies that have, you know, focused on a single platform at a time, because maybe they were just measuring your Facebook use, for example, but not necessarily comparing it to anything else. And then, you know, young people are cross-platform users, so you might try to get a hold of a friend on Snapchat and they're not answering, so you just go over to Instagram and see if you can DM them on that platform and maybe they'll answer you over there. So, and sharing videos across. So I don't know that it's something we can easily sort of separate out as one kind of social media better than another kind. They all have very similar properties for engagement. And there's probably loads of applications that some people would consider social media and others not. Like, is YouTube a social media platform? Right? For some people it is. For other people it's just a place where I go to look up like a tutorial video for plumbing related emergencies at home. Right, so it's also hard to define.
So now generative artificial intelligence is starting to become a part of social media platforms. And this is happening in two ways. One is that people are posting, human beings are posting AI-generated content, but also AIs are posting AI-generated content. Do we know anything about the implications of this on social media yet?
Ask us again in 10 years. This is really new. This is really new. Yeah,
there's only so far like stories, right? Like I'm sure you've heard about these avatars that have been generated and that you can talk to a celebrity and then it hits the news that this kid thought he was talking to some Selena Gomez and got really like enamored and like there were some serious consequences that I don't want to be quite dire. So there's just some of these news stories that seem to be like it's even more kind of sucking you in because it can really manipulate a reality of you being engaging with specific content or a person that appears to be like a celebrity. So I would say the more dimensions you add to any kind of digital content, the more you're like pulling in those areas of the brain that are like, yes, please. And that just makes me super nervous. Although I know you have a question about chatbots and mental health, which is actually kind of exciting. So
there is some research on that, right? So how about people who engage with ChatGPT and other chatbots? What's the effect with mental health there?
I think there's pretty mixed feelings about this. So a chatbot is not a replacement for therapy, but because that doesn't mean that it's not going to be a useful tool in that space. I don't have more than surface level knowledge to comment on that, but my clinician friends are very concerned about end users having overly high expectations for what a chatbot can do when they're not able to access proper mental health services. And I worry very much about, let's say, people in charge of purse strings being able to say, well, we're going to solve this problem by allocating resources to essentially automated therapy for people who have real mental health needs.
So I agree. I think this is, like, again, ask us in 10 years from here. But what I do see is, I'm a cannabis researcher. I study mental health among university students. what I see is a big barrier to seeking treatment, particularly among young men, who use cannabis. And what we are starting to see is early evidence that people are going to ChatGPT to ask, like, what does cannabis withdrawal look like? What should I expect if I want to quit cannabis? How can I do that? So it can be a low barrier way where people who normally face a lot of stigmatized attitudes and beliefs might start to get some direction towards some healthy, healthier behaviors or harm reduction techniques as it relates to substance use, for example. But I would love to see, like, oh, we see that you're, you know, asking about this. Here's some recommendations in the Ottawa area for folks that can, you know, this is a great opportunity, like, to kind of have it as part of the circle of support and care, not just a replacement for a human.
I had a study with a graduate student a number of years ago where we were interviewing youth who are homeless and that had a history of substance addiction. And they talked a lot about how much they use the internet to help them look up reliable facts about their drug use. So that was one of the most interesting things that came out of that set of conversations. And this is like, I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago now, so kind of pretty much predating AI stuff. They were, you know, very, very keen to verify facts about substance use. So, you know, having a place for people to go to get reliable information online is really helpful. And if there's a way we can integrate AI tools to do that at a high level of reliability, then I think it's pretty promising.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and coffee for giving us temporary energy by blocking our adenosine receptors. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.